So hi, welcome everybody. It's lovely to have you all here, and well done for finding it. My name is Simon Reed-Henry, and along with Sam Strong here, I'm one of the co-organisers of London Inequality Studies, which is the group that he and I have been running for 18 months or so now.
About that.
And it's essentially for people, I think probably like yourselves, who are interested in the study of inequality both as an intellectual problem but also as a political challenge, and as something that needs the two to sort of fall together. And we often talk about that in the work that we do, but it's often quite hard to find the space that we can actually address it collectively in these sorts of informal settings. So our ambition for setting up this group was to try and create conversations between people across different disciplinary bounds, because we all nod to interdisciplinarity, but we're also often stuck in our own particular, you know, way of doing things. And also to break outside of the walls of the academy as well. So we've got some people from outside academia who are also interested in the projects that we're doing, and also can engage with us in just, you know, just the sorts of ways that we need to be challenged as academics, I think. So it's a fun group, it's growing, and it's providing, I think, a useful moment and pause and space for reflection that we can all kind of get something from. And it's certainly going to be doing that today with Danny Dorling's talk, and I'm really pleased, thank you Danny, for agreeing to come talk to us. The idea is not simply that Danny offers a talk, although he's got lots to talk about. I've seen how many slides there are. You might want to...
I'll be quick.
Yeah. But it's also for us to engage in it and engage Danny and have a conversation also across the group with ourselves to try and sort of, you know, make some intellectual breakthroughs about some of these ideas. So that's very much the spirit in which we hope you'll approach the talk: to be engaged, to get involved, and to think of this as a starting point of a journey where you can join us and come to some other events that we've got happening later in the year as well. We've got in March, we've got who's next up?
Pedro.
Okay, so we've got Pedro Ramos Pinto from Cambridge, who's going to be talking about the history of ways of thinking about inequality and the numbers behind it. It's a slightly parallel approach to Danny, but I think hopefully some of the conversations we have today might carry over into that event as well. So we're delighted that you're here. Thank you very much for coming and giving of your time. And I'll hand over to... Do you want to introduce Danny? To Sam, first of all, and then in due course to Danny. Thanks.
Super. Hello, everybody. I'm Sam, as Simon has mentioned, also involved in running the group. I'm just going to say a few words to introduce Professor Danny Dorling, who is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the School of Environment and Geography in Oxford. I was having a look through some of his achievements, and there's so many honorary degrees, memberships, that you could fill a whole talk just talking about them. But recently, Danny was made an honorary doctor at University of York last year. Throughout his career, Danny has maintained a critical and analytical focus on inequality, which is so great to have him here today. And he does, in his own words, according to The Guardian anyway, he focuses on rummaging around in the numbers, data and statistics to map the things that matter to people. And I'm particularly interested to hear from Danny today because of the way he blends the role of being an academic as well as a public intellectual. And again, to quote The Guardian, Danny is both an expert and someone who is politically engaged and is able to explain simply why the subject of inequality matters to us today. So hopefully Danny will be doing a bit of that. Well, I'm sure we'll be doing a lot of that today. Specifically, his talk is going to be on peak inequality and mortality in the UK, 2015 to 2020. And Danny's going to be considering not only what is new about inequality today, but thinking about what we can learn historically and from the historical records to explain where we're at. Over to you.
Thank you. I don't mind being interrupted at all. So if anybody wants to interrupt at any point, please just put up your hand. If you don't interrupt me, I think I could do this in 30 minutes. There's plenty of time to talk, but interrupting could be more fun. I don't have great theories or, you know, a particular view on the world that comes from reading books that say it all works like this, comrades, believe me, and we can all go out and sort it out. I do have this obsession with numbers, probably unhealthy and to an extreme. So you're getting some here, you'll get lots more. Just look if you're bored and don't want to look at me at the screen. I won't go through everything. I published a book, I think, in 2018 called Peak Inequality. So I've kind of got skin in the game in that I thought then we could see it was possible that we might be at a peak. The thing about peaks of inequality is that they are very hard to identify, because when inequality gets very high, it then tends to rumble on at a peak and then slowly gets better, but that getting better process doesn't feel good normally. For us, the last peak was 1918. Inequalities in terms of income and wealth dropped in the 1920s and 30s, but nobody felt happy in the 1920s and 30s. Half of the equality this country gained was gained by 1939, but only realised years later. Hugh Dalton, who was a PhD student somewhere around here, became Chancellor, I think, in 45. His PhD was about measuring inequality, but it was almost certainly only Hugh Dalton who knew that it was falling. Things I look out for. High Pay Centre, which produces brilliant reports every year about just how greedy the bosses are being, produced a report this year, and it actually revealed that the average CEO was taking £100 less an hour than the year before. And that is the biggest fall, I think, that has occurred since the 1960s. I could be wrong. We don't have brilliant data for the past. It's certainly the biggest fall I think they've ever reported. They didn't report it as a fall. They reported it as how terrible it is they're still being paid so much. But it's interesting to think about why. And that little graph down there is a news story that came out from the University of Oxford, which again wasn't reported in this way. What the University of Oxford reported at the middle of January, when the office had gone out to undergraduate students, was that 22% of our students came from an ethnic minority, undergraduate this is, and that state school offers were 69%, which will probably translate into 67% of acceptances, admittedly from quite posh state schools, but still state schools. What they didn't say, and I've put a little hexagon or octagon at the end there, is that this is the biggest jump since 1965 in terms of admissions from state schools in the University of Oxford. You can see the 60s there. What happened in 1965 was that the corrupt practices whereby particular public schools had a direct line into particular colleges were banned. So my father went to New College, his brother went to New College, everybody from their school went to New College in the early 60s. Something's going on in my university which is interesting. It's not all great, but it's different. So I look out for signs of those kind of changes. I'm going to talk to you a lot about mortality very quickly, because that's what Simon wanted when I gave the offer. And then I'll go back to peak and end. When you're at a peak of inequality, we are the most unequal country in Europe at the most unequal time since the 1930s. Terrible things happen. Unusually bad things happen at peaks of inequality. Inequality rose dramatically in Japan in the 1930s and dramatically in Germany in the 1930s. One thing that happens is that more people die, and die in unusual ways and unusual numbers. And you'll probably know the stories from the States and how life expectancy in the States is falling and diseases of despair, and how infant mortality in the States has been rising. Well, we're the only place in Europe which is doing that. This is a quote from a government agency in November saying that no government wants to see life expectancy of its population fall on its watch. However, the risk of this happening is very real. The irony is that it has happened. It's not a risk of it happening, it's actually happened. But when you are a very unequal country, you're also remarkably bad at reporting yourself or even understanding the most basis of statistics. You can see the red line there for the life expectancy dropping here and then not rising yet, still back to its 2014 level. I call that a fall. It has fallen, it has gone down. I get criticised because apparently I should call that a slowdown, but it is now lower than it was in 2014. I won't obsess about this, but you wouldn't believe on Twitter people getting upset. In case you're wondering, life expectancy is an incredibly robust statistic. There are a tiny number of Polynesian islands where the random variation in death means that you can't tell if it's gone up or down. It does occasionally go down for other countries, but just once. It doesn't do what's happened here. Let's get through these slides. This dot really matters. Different ways of showing things matter. You probably wouldn't have noticed this dot, but in 20 slides time, I'm going to show you how important this dot is. That's 2015. This is a graph from that report. You've got to try and spot when the breaking slope might have been, and then kind of guess what could it have been. This is the HX standardized mortality rate, taking out how the population is comprised of people of different ages. Mortality falls and falls and falls. That's just what it does everywhere in the world. Now, still falling just as much in Japan as anywhere else where it's really high. Bang, something occurs a year after 2010, and then we did that. Now, it's very hard to prove causation, but it's obvious. But remember that little dot at the bottom there, because I'm going to show you later another way in which that little dot's very important. With Lou Hyam and Martin McKee, we've got a paper coming out about 2 weeks' time in the British Medical Bulletin, which has these numbers in. You don't have these, you just have these. Since 2014, roughly with a bit of variation, 1,100 babies have died in England who would not have died if we had had the infant mortality rate of Scotland. In Scotland, infant mortality way back in 2011 was 4.1. Before then, it was higher than England for decades. Falls to 3.7, 3.3, rises, falls. The latest figure is 3.2 babies, live babies dying per 1,000 born. Conversely, in England, it began rising after 2014 up to 3.7, 3.8, 3.9. Every rise is statistically significant according to ONS. What did More and Less do? The BBC programme, they produce a programme saying, oh, we're not sure it's a real rise, don't worry. All to do with weeks of gestation, stillbirths, and so on, which I'm happy to talk about, but you almost certainly none of you are interested in. But this is what I mean about things going wrong in a very unequal country. When you have the first consecutive rise in infant mortality at any pair or 3 years since the Second World War, and the worst record anywhere in Europe, rather than actually saying something's going badly wrong, people say, oh, probably isn't real. Or they say, oh, it's people flying in, it's all those immigrants. Or they say, and the Conservative MP actually said to me in the House of Commons, I said, Danny, it's only gone up from 3.6 to 3.9. Why are you worrying about it? And those are the figures, just in case anybody wants to have an argument later about whether life expectancy is lower. It's almost back to 2014. We don't know what's going to happen. We'll next find out in June whether we finally manage to go back over or not. And a lot of that will depend on migration. Who didn't come back home this Christmas having flown back to the mainland of Europe? Which we don't know. This is how good it can be, and this is how bad it can be. We're going to get a few slides about Finland, because I have an obsession with Finland. Finland is the place that does best in Europe. We're the place that does worse. Finland has the lowest inequality. Finland has the best schools. Finland has no homelessness. Yesterday, a rather shabby man walked into my office, and I didn't actually know what he did. A bit older than me. Turned out he was the person who devised the scheme in Finland whereby they have no homelessness.
Oh, he's cool, isn't he?
He's very cool.
I've met him.
He's very cool. And he told me 35 years ago he'd come to London to learn about what to do about homelessness and thought, you don't know what you're doing. Went back, and lots of campaigning, lots of arguing, lots of devising a policy where you house people first. Now he's being flown in to advise us. He just looked at me and he said, you haven't got a hope because you don't really want to get rid of homelessness, do you? Anyway, I'll try not to depress you. Finland a few years ago, only 97 babies died in 1 year. It's the lowest infant mortality rate in the history of the species in any nation state. You can find a part of Tokyo that does better, but not a country. 1.7 thousand. Finland is now neonatal mortality, is at the top of Luxembourg. It all depends where the hospital is in Luxembourg, to be honest. The UK, when I was born we were probably one, maybe two, because we had the first baby incubators in the world in the 1960s. By 1990, we were seventh. We dropped down by 2015 to 19th. And that's just the ranking of neonatal mortality rates, and since then it's got dramatically worse. So again, it's a kind of question. Here's Romania, here's Bulgaria, here's us. We've got Boris, 40 new hospitals, some very small ones, but there will be 40. And what's possible? That's where we are.
Could you just give an overview of what Finland
does?
I'm not familiar with Finland, so
okay.
Could you give some headlines of what Finland is doing, especially about homelessness? That is
okay. On homelessness, they have a policy of housing first. So if you are homeless on the streets, you are put in a flat before anybody deals with your drug or alcohol problems or your mental health or anything else. And it just is cheaper, it works better. There are lots of places around the world that are beginning to try and mimic it, and there are parts of Britain trying. But to get to that point, you have to sort out other things. You have to have a decent education system for a couple of decades where your population actually become more able, where people are not divided, where you think it really matters, where those people are like you. On the infant mortality in Finland, superficially, what they do is a mixture of what they've done since the 40s, which is you actually get care with a health visitor, but properly from the point when you know you're pregnant. You know, we get, if it's your first baby, you get a visit, but they're stretched. But also you get their sort of magic baby box, which is a baby box, I think with 200 items, none of which are put in there to advertise to try to get you to buy down, you know, particular nappies and things. We have a commercial baby box in Britain. Scotland, I should have said, Scotland have invested money in midwives and in better care and are going to fund child benefit for the third child and so on. So they're mimicking what the Scandinavians do. And already they've moved their infant mortality rate a third of the way to the Scandinavian rate. Can't prove it's because of what they've done, it's just coincidence with the investment in that. It's cheap, because so few babies are now born. It's the easiest policy and easiest statistic to move. Whereas you contrast that with numerous stories in Britain of maternity units closing. You know, my affluent county of Oxfordshire, I think it was 2 years ago, there's a news story saying we have six places where you can give birth with midwives. Five were closed with almost no notice. All the midwives were told to come into the JR, into just one. And if you were pregnant and very near term, you had to check on Facebook to see whether you had to go into the JR rather than where you're supposed to give birth. The problem with that is that the roads of Oxford are completely clogged at 7:30 in the morning. And that's where the hospital is. So people are giving birth on the side of the roads. And it's all much more complicated than that. And of course there will be. No other country has done this kind of nosedive. So there's something odd that's happened to Britain. There are loads of indicators where we do badly on, and loads of indicators, in fact, well over 100, where someone like Finland does incredibly well. This is just press freedom in. Indices. And these things are connected because in a country like Finland, if infant mortality was devised slightly, it would be a major national news story. In Britain, it isn't. That's the book. That's my co-author, and that's Happiness Indicators. I can go on and on about Finland. It is just ridiculous. But of course, there always will be. You could do the same in the States. You could pick the most liberal, nice, you know, northeast coast, fairly affluent, although Finland is an affluent state in the US, and compare it to Alabama and Louisiana, and you get these dramatic contrasts. It's just that we're not kind of Alabama and Louisiana. You know, we were the heart of an empire. So it's a question of what exactly has gone wrong. And the kind of thing that goes right. This is European data, Eurostat data on happiness. The Finns are the most likely to say they're happy most of the time. And this is for Finns with a degree or Finns with no qualification, because it's an equitable country. The UK isn't there because we failed to fill in the survey that we should have done for Eurostat. And here there won't be too many of these, but this is the proportion of people who say they can choose when they work. Employees who actually have flexible job hours. And in Finland, it's over 50% of people who've got a degree can actually choose what days they work and what hours, but it's still 40% of the lowest skilled workers. So if you try and get some chips in Helsinki at about 10 o'clock at night, it's remarkably difficult, because people can choose if they want to serve food at that time of night, and they choose not to. And you have a whole league table. We are somewhere, there's England, there's the United States. But I like comparing countries. There are always different reasons why and anomalies. There's one country with a high proportion of farmers who have a high degree of flexibility about when they farm, but they have to farm. Another huge difference is you're sort of saying, how does Finland do it? Being educated together, it's much easier to be sensible about how you run a country if you actually know other people in your country, and you're not separated in some cases from birth, you know, from them, because your name was put down to go to a particular school. Norway and Finland, they do have private schools. Their spending on them is absolutely minuscule. Whereas these countries are quite like, if you don't know, Chile, I think all the train lines in Santiago, the underground, still don't work since the riots before Christmas. A kind of falling apart nation run by a billionaire. Australia, falling apart nation with fires run by coal, that kind of thing going on. United States, we don't have any more. And then us, you know, we're down in this league table of highly unequal, highly divided places, where you end up dividing your children as well and dividing your education and spending, in our case, almost a third of the income on just that goes to schools on 7% of children, because you have a theory that those 7% are so special that they should have more spent on them because they'll become great leaders. Or a theory that wouldn't it be nice if everybody had the high quality privileged education I had? You know, that kind of thing. And you go, yes, there's a way of doing it. They can speak 4, 5, or 6 languages, it's cheaper. But no, not where we're stuck at the moment. So we're not alone. There are other countries as unequal as us, but we're very odd, and we're an extreme when it comes to Europe. You have to go to Chile and Australia and the US and Israel, actually, to find other ones. Apologies if you've seen this before. I just keep on showing this graph. It's public spending as a proportion of GDP. So essentially, it's roughly how much do you tax and how much you spend on public services. The reason it all zooms up here is the bailout of the banks, which happens almost everywhere. Ireland followed our advice from George Osborne, and then very cleverly altered the rules on Amazon and Google and so on, because they had to, because they bankrupted themselves following our advice. So I won't say any more about Ireland. Finland, 57% taxation and public service spending. Things work. France, 54. Always kind of wonder if they went from 54 to 57, would they all be rioting on the streets of France or not? Germany, 43. Labour Party manifesto proposed tax rises and spending. Well, spending, slightly less honest about tax rises, I think. Spending to move this line from here, which is us, to there. That was inconceivable. That cannot be allowed to happen. That was not allowed to happen. Because the change of going from here to here destroys the normal life of the top 5%. Most people in the top 5%. It wasn't going from here to here. Nobody suggests going from where the UK is to being like Finland, at least, you know, in less than 50 years. But we actually did have a choice at the last election. Normally you only have about 1 or 2% difference between the parties in terms of public spending promises. This one was bigger. And of course, you know, Germany isn't a failed state because it taxes and spends 43% on public services. Germany spends an extra billion euros a week on its health services than we do. Billion, not 350 million, quite a billion. And you can't do that without setting up your country in a different way. This is income inequality data for Finland, just to show you how boring it is. and how little changes. It's the shares of the 1% and the 9% and so on. And this is the graph over a century. Four countries, sorry, they're not obvious. This is Sweden, which was very unequal. They're all very unequal. Everywhere in the rich world was unequal 100 years ago. This is a nice place to be doing this lecture because it was big townhouses, servants at the bottom, servants at the top, and the top 1% taking a quarter of everything. Then you get this huge fall in inequality that happened almost everywhere, and you get to the time of greatest equality in the 70s, and different countries go different ways. The US goes up, back up to here. The UK up to here, about 15%, taken by the best 1%, about best off 1%. Sweden about here, Finland down there. Really nice natural experiment. If you're a social scientist and you're kind of thinking, how can we test what happens with different levels of inequality? I know, let's get this. And then we'll see. And it isn't always directly because the US is unequal, this happens. The inequality is often part of a symptom of something else in the US. And that something else which allows the US to be so unequal is also why the US cannot work out how to do a health service that works for most of its people. Going to show you a bit about the mortality, and particularly 2015. There was a good reason why it wasn't a huge news story when this biggest rise in deaths for a long time came out, and that's because the data were released on the day in which the referendum result was released. That was scheduled, it wasn't conspiracy, 24th of June 2016, but it was a big news day. So the biggest rise in mortality since the Second World War wasn't noticed, all picked up afterwards. And I went to see what was on the news then, and it was Boris Johnson saying there was no need for haste, apparently, about leaving the EU on the day. The government said it's flu, had said it's flu before, Public Health England said it's flu, carried on saying it's flu afterwards. If you want to know what a flu epidemic looks like, it tends to come in minus 5 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks to a peak, and then goes down again. That's what flu looks like when flu kills lots of people in the past. We could be there now with something coming from China, but they're not panicking. Because the mortality rate of that particular virus appears to be much lower amongst people who are not very elderly. But anyway, it wasn't flu. That was the reason. Now, if you remember, I said at the very beginning about that little dot that was lower. Another way of looking at it. These are the biggest increases in mortality that have occurred in any calendar year, I think, since we started recording it properly around about 1832. So the worst year ever was 1918, which was mainly the pandemic of influenza and the First World War, but the flu was far worse, and a 24% rise in mortality in 1918. The next worst year was 1940. Bombing, wounded soldiers coming back, and so on. The next worst year in this series, that's almost 200 years old, was the extremely cold winter of 1929 and mass poverty. The next was the Great Frost of 1895. The next was cholera, if you know about John Snow, of 1846. The cholera 3 years later, in 1849. And then the next worst year in the history of British mortality was 2015. And it matters. You know, it is a big, big kind of event that's just been passed away as a kind of blip. And the ones after it. You know, 1911, 1915, 1931, 1890. You've got to go all the way to 1968, actually, to get the flu epidemic that had an effect much smaller. Around about 2010, when David Cameron came into office, he announced he was going to have a happiness measure. Does anybody remember that? Was it too far away? Yeah, we'll measure how happy people are. And the Office of National Statistics were told they had to create a happiness index. And so they did, and it contains about 30 things. It reports every year. Nobody ever looks at it. It contains four measures about health. And this is what was told in around about 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013. The proportion of people in Britain who said they were completely satisfied with their health plummeted. The proportion of people who said they were dissatisfied jumped up. The proportion of people who said that they were somewhat satisfied dropped substantially. The proportion who said they were completely dissatisfied jumped up. So we actually asked the people of Britain about their health every year, and they told us, it's like Spike Milligan, you know, when he suddenly gets grave, he said, I told you I'm ill. People in Britain said that their health was getting worse before the big rise in mortality actually occurred. And the speed of those changes were assumed when these graphs were first shown to epidemiologists. They just said, this has to be an error. Can't be true. Things like that don't happen that fast. Must be a change in recording. But then after the deaths rose, you didn't see that much. This is what the actuaries of Britain produce, the people who look after private pensions mainly. Private pensions have had a bonanza. Billions have been wiped off the liabilities of private pensions because life expectancy stopped rising. I've got 300 billion was reported really early on. And you've got to remember, people who get private pensions are better off. Right? So this is affecting people across the board. It affects the poor slightly more in Scotland, we know that, but not so much. So the life expectancy of people over 65 dropping from being halfway to 25 and a half years down to just over 24 years for women, and for men 23 down to 22. But you might say, well, it's only a year. But it hasn't happened before outside wartime. The only place where it's happened before is Russia after 1989. The reporting on this, when the latest statistics came out, which were June of last year, which as I show revealed yet more of mortality getting worse, the BBC brought on Population Matters, who had a group who used to be called the Optimum Population Trust, who wants an optimum population for the world that's smaller than it is, and they're really worried about migration into Britain. And they wanted to talk about migration. I won't go through the news stories, but we're not very good at reporting this. The Guardian. The Guardian decided to report that the 275 number of net migrants don't of course exist, it's the difference between two numbers, was high, didn't look at their death figures. The data that ONS released actually tells you, and they always use Coventry when they talk about migration, you know, a town the size of Coventry. If there had been a really spotty journalist, they could have gone through and found out for Coventry just how many people had died of age 86, 87 and so on. The ONS released everything. All those red numbers are where mortality rose last year. It was reported last year to have risen from the year before. Which is the vast majority of ages. And this is for women. I'm not going to spend time on it. I'm just not making it up. I'm not cherry picking. I would expect the figures to come out in June to actually not be like this, but I'm not sure. If you put it on a graph, those are the rises in the most recent period. And this is for Wales. This is interesting. If you try to think, how big is this? This is life expectancy as reported by ONS for different countries. And you can see ours falling by how much of a year. So combined about a fifth of a year at that point. And there were falls in other countries, but only for 1 year, and since then they've gone up again. I didn't spot it at first, but the comparative figure is Japan. It was actually Japan, I think, in 2011. Now, that drop in life expectancy in Japan was the tsunami. If you remember the tsunami in the whole East Coast and Fukushima, that was big, a huge disaster. So for women, we're currently at about a half of a tsunami deaths in terms of magnitude. the biggest of any country, but not as bad as what happened in Japan in that year. For men, it's at about 70% of the rate in Japan because far fewer men died. And fewer children. In Japan, the primary schools are put on little hills. Nobody quite knew why they had a tradition of putting primary schools on small hills near the coast until the tsunami came. But that gives you an idea of the... that's the equivalent that's happened. But it hasn't happened because of tsunami, and it hasn't happened because of flu. It's almost certainly happened because we've over halved the number of social workers who visit elderly people. Meals on Wheels have changed, the health services in crisis, the trolleys are backed up, you can't discharge people. People in care homes who've got Alzheimer's are now dying far faster than they used to die in care homes. You can't get the staff to work in care homes and nursing homes, partly because you introduce a hostile policy. So those Filipino nurses who used to staff care homes in London went home, and then other people went home. And then you hire a bloke my age, completely unsuited to the job, and the next thing you know, he's on Panorama having been secretly filmed in a care home. You know, so I'm trying to give you a mess of all the different things that may contribute to this. I think five more slides and I'll stop. So please think of questions. So we have an awful disaster with health. It's been dramatic. We don't know where it's going next. We do know that in Scotland they are sorting things out, and in England they're not. Why might we be at a peak of income and wealth inequality? What are the kind of indicators? One, the safest statistics in Britain are mortality statistics, because to put it crudely, nobody wants to die. We have lots of data. And the other is house prices. Because really, people try very, very hard not to sell their house for less than they can get, and they try very hard not to spend more money buying a house than they have to. So in terms of good quality data that you can monitor, house prices in London, they're still falling. Little dip on the outer Met, but still falling on the outer southeast. If house prices, if the fall that's been going on since 2016 in London were to accelerate, at the moment it's a kind of Boris bounce, not in terms of buying, but in terms of people putting them on the market because they think they can sell them. If house prices go down, we have a dramatic wealth equality increase. And other things occur, but that's kind of in the balance. Four of the G7 countries are recording falls in income inequality. Most of the OECD countries are recording falls in income inequality. Most of the world is recording falls in income inequality within most countries. These are slight. The standard story is that inequality is rising everywhere. The lovely people from Oxfam produce a report at Davos every year, telling you it's even worse than the year before, and you know, half a billionaire in a bus. Yeah, owns more than the kind of bottom three quarters or whatever, right? And that's kind of the job of Oxfam. But that doesn't carry on forever. You can look at the 1,000 richest people and look at how many people drop out of that list, but it's marginal. But the actual measures we have on income inequality are suggesting more falls continuously, not just since 2008, but more recently. This is the last election looked at in a particular way. If you're feeling depressed about the election, this is my crudest summary of it. You have 66 million people in Britain. So let's just have a square for each million. We do it by age. So I split the country up into 11 age groups, because 6 times 11 makes 66. So it's nice and easy. We have 6 million children aged 6 or less. We know exactly what they did in the election. They didn't vote. So they're all light grey. We have 6 million aged 7 to 14. They didn't vote. This is all to the nearest million, so it goes wrong for small groups. This is my where I've shoved the ones in who wouldn't have been allowed to vote even if we'd given children a vote, because they're not UK resident or Irish or the other groups allowed to vote. 15 to 22-year-olds, some of them can't vote because they're 15, 16, 17. If they did vote, they vote Labour, 2 million. But 3 million of them don't vote. 23 to 28-year-olds, 2 million vote Labour. We've got a million in Green and Plaid. I had to put the Green and Plaid somewhere. And from the survey data, that's the kind of age group. And still 3 million don't vote. 29 to 35, 2 million Labour. another million who can't vote because they are EU but not UK citizens, 2 million don't vote, and finally the Liberals get their first kind of million. The Liberals have 4 million, that margin's SNP. Anyway, you go down to that. It's not until you get to 43 that you get the Tories beginning to come in. And you get 2 million, and you get 3 million Tories after 57. And over 74, you actually get 4 million Tories, but still 2 million people not voting. But it isn't just that Labour is young. By the way, Labour isn't posh. All the stuff about class is incredibly badly done with the last election. Because your ABC, 1DE social classes are so affected by age and what age you were when you got your job. So we have lots of graduates now who are doing a call centre job, but it can count as Class B, even if they're precarious. Labour have the young and Labour have a stretch of the old. The services are mainly old. And that's a potential sign that the increase of that divide of a sign of things potentially changing. Have I done the wrong way? I think I put that one in a second time. There we go. Changes over time. There are some long trends which are changing. This is the segregation index of Conservatives. So it's the proportion of Conservatives you'd have to move across the country to get an even number of Conservatives everywhere. It's a segregation measure. It used to be high. It came down to just about 6%. If you chose the right 6% of Tories in the 1960s, you could have an even spread of Tories. It went up and up and up. I haven't added the last two dots. But 2017 it went down, and of course 2019 the segregation index went down a lot. And the northern, it's not a red wall, it's suburban northern areas that we tend to associate with poverty because we have a particular prejudice about the word Grimsby, but we don't realise that that's where pensioners have moved back up to and made their money in the south and who's there. But essentially this very long term increase in segregation of the country has now in two elections in a row moved. You get the same one for health, but with the 1930s mucking up the nice pattern. And you get the same for income inequality, where we're teetering at a peak. So, depressing, highly messy country, terrible things happening which have not happened for 50 or 60 years, but no evidence that we are set to carry on up this road and the billionaires will get richer, and 99% of us will happily vote to get poorer and will be fooled. Two pictures for you just to end about the extremes of things. I took this picture, I think, in about May last year. I was staying just here at Trinity College, Cambridge. That's Trinity College, Cambridge. It was dawn. And I took this picture because there were people sleeping in the tents outside Trinity. The important thing about Trinity is it's the richest college of any in Oxford or Cambridge in the UK. So rich, it's trying to leave the pension scheme because it doesn't want that building being part of the liability for the pension scheme. But you have homeless people outside the gates of Trinity. A few weeks ago, a woman gave birth to twins who was homeless at the time, just outside there. And it made the headlines for one day. And because of confidentiality, you have no idea whether her twins have survived or not, whether they're still with her. It can't all be said. But she gave birth on the street at about that time of morning. And last one is the gates of Trinity Oxford, because we now have people sleeping rough outside the gates of Trinity Oxford, I think for the first time in centuries. Can't find any reports of this. When infant mortality is rising, when life expectancy is falling, when you've got people sleeping outside the tents of your Oxford and Cambridge colleges, you know something is up, it's extreme. It doesn't mean you're going to become the USA. It means that things are out of control. It means they're extremely bad. The question is whether this country, by which I mean England, not the UK, can somehow be hijacked and its people made stupid and it made to pretend it isn't in Europe and actually accept this as normal, or whether you will get an increased sense of anger and distrust. In the past, it has really, really helped when the middle class have lost out. You tend to get inequality increases when the middle class can no longer afford a doctor, as they couldn't in the 1930s, when the middle class can't get their children into the grammar school or the private school. And we're in a situation where if you're not in the top 1%, you're looking at a high degree of precarity for you or your children at the moment. I tend to be an optimist. I do worry about being too optimistic. And I may grasp at the things which appear to be getting better or suggesting a turn. I'll go back just to one last graph to try and convince you. Each of those squares is an election. Okay? They make no difference to the long-term trends on inequality. It's a much longer process than individual elections. It's not that voting and parties and so on doesn't matter, but it isn't like you win one election and you will make the turn. It isn't that. This couple of elections, two that took place in 1974, were really, really crucial. It was a longer-term process of people in British society, particularly people at the very top, who had watched their power disappear under this greater equality. Their grandparents had ruled the planet, and they really wanted it back. And some laziness from others, and they worked and got it back. This turn here, we know it happened everywhere. It's coincident with the Russian Revolution. It's coincidence with trade unions. It's coincidence with a whole set of things that occurred. But individual elections, as of themselves, don't suddenly usher in utopia. I'll stop there. Please ask away. Well, tell me what I'm most wrong about. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've got plenty of time for questions, and that was a really thought-provoking talk. Perhaps if anybody would like to kick us off, just can stick your hand up and we can...
Just to start, and thanks, that was really interesting. You presented some really, you talked about lots of kind of correlations and the difficulties of, I'm not a statistician, but the difficulty of proving causation.
Yeah.
I wonder why that is and whether some of these outcomes are kind of have a more significant statistical relationship with inequality than others, and why that might be.
Okay, yeah. There are things where we can now prove causation, where we have cohort studies. And you can follow children through and you even know their genes and so on. So we're beginning to be able to work out just how much less valuable an A from a particular school is than an A from another school, and causation. With this, you would need about 100 planets all running simultaneously with about 30 affluent countries to get enough statistics to actually be able to say these things were true. It's far too small. So the terrible, so I was more of a historian, I've never done a talk to historians because they would just start swearing at me. Because you just, you know, this is talking about history and events, and I'm trying to look at it by comparison. What we can say, if you look at the Spirit Level book, where their way of making it firm was to cite several hundred other studies. The weakest correlation of that was life expectancy. That was the weakest of all their correlations. And I'm talking about mortality. And the life expectancy correlation is weak because life expectancy is affected by things that occur to you over your whole life. So if you happen to have grown up in a ridiculously equal country where you went on holiday because that was normal, where you could play with other children because it's normal. This is my country, this is England in the 1970s, where people in Sheffield lived longer than average than England. But then you still live in this country now, you have to average out the effects of a good childhood and a bad middle age. So the life expectancy one is the weakest, but still strong enough to show. Infant mortality tends to react quite quickly to events because what it's a mixture of who becomes pregnant, what happens to the woman in the 9 months, and then of course most of the deaths are within days of being born. But infant mortality is still affected by grandmother's circumstances. So we have a little bit, this is not, you cannot do statistical proof about inequality.
And is there a biological limit on life expectancy? Because would somebody say, well, at some point it has to tail off?
So far, Japan hasn't slowed. And Japan, by the way I measure it, is almost as equal as Finland. By the way the OECD measure it, that they say it isn't. Japan has an enormous number of single elderly personal households. So how you adjust for that changes. There's no slowdown yet. The WHA don't predict a slowdown, but it's too high. However, the number of very old people in the world, the kind of 124-year-olds, they're not rising. There are a group of old demographers who are obsessed with top-end life expectancy. And my best guess at looking at it is that I think it is slowing. But more than that, it's a pretty miserable set of years once you're past 105. Apart from the fact that the Queen writes you a birthday card every year after then. But we shouldn't worry about it. It's going to affect a tiny number of people for at least a century and a half. So my students at Oxford who are female, we actually do a calculation where I get the class to work out their likely day of death. Given what drugs they take and other things, which I do. And we do get a few of the young women who will be at 100 on average. But Finland has to deal with a quarter of its population of pensionable age. We have far less, America has far less. One problem with equality and wording things well, you do end up with an awfully large number of very old people.
You mentioned the difficulty in reading any media reports about the increased mortality, not just in 2016, but subsequently. What do you attribute the angle taken on those stories to? Innumerate journalists, media capture, or the lack of interest in old people and the suspicion that they're probably poor people as well?
We got shocked by this. This is working with Mike McKee and Lou Hyam in particular, because we published paper after paper. The 23 press officers of the Department of Health deserve a special mention in history and should all be named, and they should have their biographies written, particularly the one who'd done a degree in business studies, who particularly came after, you know. There are 23 people in the Department of Health whose job seemed to be to write stories denying what was really happening. With a set format. People have never lived longer, we've got heart disease down, fewer people are smoking or something like that. And they did the same again and again and again, and the press have to report, or feel they have to report their stock answer. We FOI'd the Department of Health, and they said the number of times they gave this out was too many to make it economical to answer our question on it. That's just one. Tired journalists, and journalists needing to come up with a news story, and it's not new anymore, it's not news, but even worse, a sense that this might not be a bad thing. In a time of austerity, when things are tight, elderly people dying faster, so it costs less, might be a price worth paying that you don't talk about but you don't worry about. So the first dramatic fall was in women over age 85. It was just 2 weeks in 2012. And then it was mainly women, and women are a bit younger, and because women are much more likely to be on their own, because they're with a man but the man's died already. Men are much more likely to have a woman at that age, and she'll look after them. On average she's 5 years younger than them, because of the age at which people used to get together. On average, she'll live 5 years longer than them. We have a particular disregard for elderly women, or the way I put it here, but I'm careful. If Harold Shipman hadn't targeted elderly women, he would have been caught earlier. That's a way of doing it. It was a shock about 3 or 4 years into this to begin to realise that it didn't matter to quite a lot of people we were talking to, because of who it was. And, partly an assumption it's the poor, but also for the middle class, this is my mother in the nursing home in the Cotswolds, and she's either going to die at 87 or 84, and if she dies at 84, I don't have to drive and see her so much because of how we arrange things, or even worse, you're sitting there in London, you're in your 40s or 50s, and you're kind of renting somewhere, and you're sick of it, and the minute they die in that 3-bed house on the outskirts of Tunbridge Wells, you've got your deposit. I mean, we're a kind of dog-eat-dog country where the wealth really matters for the middle class, not for the working class, because there isn't any wealth. So mum and dad going a bit earlier, just a sense of... Whereas if we did live nearer to our relatives, this is the middle class, and we got on better with them, and we actually valued them, we might actually worry more about this happening.
My area is homelessness. I've got a homeless, I'm founded a homeless shelter. I'm not very good on statistics or academia, but I'm constantly asked by papers and media and everybody. It's kind of poverty porn, a huge amount of poverty porn people try to get us to engage with. I mean, I just always tell the volunteers to say, come to fuck off. But there seems to be, what's the word? People are invested in the idea that the homeless are junkies and winos, that they're mentals, or you come up with the name, paedophiles. I mean, for a new shelter, I've just got planning permission for, all the locals got together and said that their children would be at risk from paedophiles. I mean, there's I'm not a statistician, but I doubt if there's any evidence at all to suggest that homeless people are any more likely to be paedophiles than anyone else. But I think we do know that it's mostly in people's homes that most abuse happens. So there seems to be a real investment in suggesting that it is the fault of other, it's people's own fault that they're in this situation, and that if only they were doughty, hardworking, sort of deserving for all that worked out. Mm. I mean, at the moment in our shelter, we've got 38 people, and over half of them are in employment. And that's how I met that Finnish dude who just says, he says, people invite me here all the time to talk about housing first, doing pilots. He said, you don't need a pilot, you just house people, it works. Mm. And there's no, it seems that like it's this idea that you've got to pay. So, there's not only got to pay, but people have to make money out of it. They've got to make money out of the care homes, they've got to make money, you know, so our people are on poverty wages, living in a homeless shelter, going out to work every day, and paying over 50% of their wages in, if they could help to get into rent. But there seems to be, there's just so much invested in it. I mean, you hear it all the time, it's on the telly, you've got those Channel 5 dot, you know that.
We had this move towards blaming the victim and individualising things. So DCLG, Department of Community and Housing, produced a report last year about homelessness, which was all individualised over the main causes were about mental health or about the person. They then produced a report in September 2019 saying some new evidence has emerged suggesting it isn't all individual. And the ridiculous thing, there's been evidence for decades. We know what kind of circumstances make homelessness more likely and less likely in a society and at what kind of times. And here in London, in 47, 48, one count, there were only 6 homeless people around this part of London. So it has nothing to do with individual, it's all about the circumstances and then who ends up. It's high, but...
We also know it's not the Roma.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the number of times I've had TV, and particularly Vanessa Feltz, the producers filling up asking if I want to talk about the Roma.
No, they do, but Oxford City Council assumed that most of the homeless in Oxford were people who come in, until we got our very big rise in deaths in January and February last year, and the majority of homeless people who died were around about my age and had grown up in Oxford. And one was a boy in a year below me at school, one was a year below my brother at school, one was looked after as a child by somebody I work with, who was the one who stabbed themselves in the groin in McDonald's and bled to death in front of children. That was the most extreme. Well, there was one Polish man who died on the bridge from the train station who nobody could identify. And there are people being buried in churchyards by Christian groups in Oxford. In one ward, we've counted 91 deaths in 15 years. And dying homeless is now the most common way to die in Oxford under the age of 65. And it's shocking when you first hear it. And I can remember being shocked when the picture of this lad came up on my phone over, can somebody identify him? He was discharged from a prison and given a tent by a charity on discharge. And the problem is you get used to it. You get used to it. And it's how do you fight back from not being used to it? And how do you get past the stigma where you never say you know anybody is homeless, or you all pretend, even though most of you will know a friend or a friend of a friend or a cousin or you, but the shame is so high that you don't do that, and so we can have this. And there are people politically who want there to be people on the streets because they want there to be a warning.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
In Duncansville, yes, it's because you're not a douchey, decent person that's working. And I'm sure that the sums are there about universal credit. I mean, it's the devil's work. It's evil. Absolutely evil. And we did actually have a bloke about your age, don't know how old you are, he was 55.
That's near.
Didn't. Okay, you can only inherit your council flat once. So he was a carer for his dad, who must have inherited it from his mum, Islington, that's where I operate. Looked after his dad for all those years, so had a bit of training as a carer. When his dad died, he got evicted, and the Universal Credit went to him. We did actually manage to get him a job in a really nice care home at £14 an hour, which is not bad for London, you know, for that sort of work. But he never really worked like that, and he put his back out.
Yeah.
He's in hospital still.
Yeah.
Homeless. I mean, do you know, so even when people really try to do what we've been told to do.
But it's one of the things that's gone on with the increasing deaths in the care homes has been as the amount of staff has gone down because they've got to pay the rent to the private equity firm that now owns the home. So you get one person trying to put somebody back in bed, and you need two people to put somebody back in bed. It can get very, very, very depressing when you go through it. It's how, you know, this is all our last year of life, you know. Well, I smoke, so I might be looking at not quite so long. But the better behaviour you are, the more you go to the gym, the more you swim, the more you don't get fat, the more you look after your body, the longer you're probably going to spend in that care home. And the irony, and what I can't work out is how we have this disconnect from it is in your selfish personal interest to try to have a society in which you're, in some ways, possibly most important year of life, the last one, the one in which you may suffer or it can be done really well, and we just don't want to think about it. So stories of Americans' last year of life are terrible. At the most extreme of being put in a coma because the private healthcare company can keep billing if you've got a pulse. Anyway, I won't go and get... Sorry. Try and be positive. You know, most unequal country in Europe at the worst time since 1936. Of course, the stories have to be bad. The positive thing is that the only way is up.
You know, but I mean, how many nice middle class millennials have to be murdered by people who should be having mental health care, you know, somewhere being housed? I mean, how much, you know, you just think, but surely, I mean, there was one in Tufnell Park a couple of years ago. There's one here. You see these stories if you're a kind of a loser that watches the reads all the papers all the time. You just think, well, surely that herd thing, whatever they call it, you know, surely those people will now say, hey, you know what, that could be my kid tomorrow who's being knifed to death by somebody who needs care, who needs housing, who needs some answers.
They could, but what they do instead is says, we cannot possibly live in that neighbourhood, we can't live there, we can't let our children go to the local school, even though the local school's got a giant wall around it, it's completely safe inside. And the house prices rise higher and higher in parts of Fulham.
But it never works, does it? It's like those gated communities. They always get over, like in South Africa, they always get over the wall.
Yeah.
They trick you, don't they?
But the herd community, you know, half of all young women going to university, the vast majority having a debt that their parents won't pay for them. The best of 10th for students, mum and dad pay the debt, so they've got no student loan. Looking at a debt that will repay back as 60,000 to 100 if they get a reasonable job on double the 14 an hour. Not being able to get a mortgage for somewhere to live, not being able to start a family, and that's the middle class. At some point that begins to kick in. It kind of kicked in with Brexit. The people who voted for Brexit were middle-income Tory voters in middle southern England who could see no future for their grandchildren. It's just that they were told, if you stop the immigrants coming, everything will be okay. So there's enormous disaffection out there. But it can be channeled in particular ways.
I was going to say, just looking at the graph on the board, and you mentioned sort of before 1920, I imagine communism and the Russian Revolution. Does it have to be something as, in your opinion, something as big as that? Is it, say, sort of, could it be something like America, Bernie Sanders, socialist, becoming president in the heart of neoliberalism to be able to trigger?
To trigger the, it's trick, well.
Does it need a trigger, is that?
Well, the problem is you identify a trigger, whether, but in your head, when you see an historical event, we tend to identify a trigger, whereas it could just have. What we do know about this is that most countries in Europe did that. The US actually carried on until 1945 and then came down. So it was a bit late. And the big difference, although the Russian Revolution, and knowing you could be put against the wall and shot, helped. So Tawney and Beveridge were both rugby schoolboys. Yeah. A very large number of the left or more progressive came from families who were very well off, and they became progressive after that up against the wall moment. But the big one for Europe was this war, which was supposed to last weeks, lasting years, the First World War. Enormous costs of that war, almost entirely borne by the richest 1% of society, because nobody else had the money. So I would say that one of the big triggers of why Europe saw equality fall before the US was paying for an unexpected, expensive, long war. And other things that happened in that war, like the rent strikes, it increased activism. But we're not sure. This teetering around is happening now. And it's, the nice thing is that countries with very low rates of inequality are also doing the teetering. So we are very odd. To have got up back this high is not normal. And there's something different about us to the rest of Europe that meant we're like this, which I think has to do with the empire. And the fact that our rich families used to be really, really rich, and so that fall is bigger. What somebody really needs to do is take this back further, and they have kind of with bread prices and so on. So Piketty tends to say it was always very unequal, then we have this brief moment and we could lose it. But what I've seen looking back is you get continuous cycles of high inequality, low inequality. But the data gets worse and worse and worse. And then on the really long scale of things, there's a nice kind of coincidence between the beginnings of new religions and times of extreme inequality and places. So where Muhammad talks about the need for people to pay a 2% tax coming in particular cities in the Arabian Peninsula, it was about the behaviour of merchants then. Roman occupation of Judea. But also the Buddha was a rich boy, talking about this isn't the way. And you can go, if you want, you can go through world religions, which tend to come out with be nice to your neighbours, don't be too greedy. There's a very long kind of history of inequality and of human beings finding different ways at different times to control the greedy. And then the greedy get out of control. For a time, your inequality rises very, very high. But the natural mechanism is that things fall apart so much that you can't sustain. The most annoying country for us for years was Chile. Chile seemed to be getting away with it. You know, incredibly high inequality, really expensive university fees. And then suddenly out of nowhere it cracks and you get what happened in December. Whereas you don't get that in the really equal countries. You don't have that kind of disturbance in Japan, you don't have it anywhere in Scandinavia, you don't get it in Denmark.
How does France map onto that?
They're interesting. And everything doesn't always fit, you're right. It'd be hard to work out to measure what a really serious protest in France. So we're what? There's a European survey which asks, have you ever been on a protest or a strike? We're the lowest in Europe, only one in six adults have ever been on a protest or a strike. The next lowest is Germany, which is one in three. The French are over 50%, and the Greeks are good at it. You're not a proper Greek child if you haven't been in that square in Athens. I won't go on because I'm not sure, but it certainly helps. The French, by the way, are, of the large European countries, the most equitable. You get paid more benefit for your third child if you're French than for the second, unlike here where you get nothing for your third. Protest has an effect. It might help explain why France still has over 50% spending on public services. I think the Finnish way is more clever and cheaper. You know, just do it. Don't have to do it over wearing vests and going on the streets. Have an elite who are not like Macron. Have an educational system where you don't have the suborn. You have universities that everybody goes to. It's cleverer.
Danny, I just wanted to, in a sense, push you out of the sort of national husk of a lot of these arguments, you know, comparing France, what's it like in France, what's it like in history, how the history of those two places played out. Because you gave one of your examples earlier on was about mortality, or expectations of life expectancy at birth. Mm. And so the only place that it sort of went down was in post-Soviet, post-socialist sense. The other place where it went down globally was in sub-Saharan Africa during the same, during a similar or slightly earlier period, if you compare sort of 75 to 2005. And that, of course, is the effect of structural adjustment policies and so forth, i.e. international frameworks that are affecting the national conditions under which you can make policy. So I'm sort of trying to think of bringing that back to your discussion, the one that we've had earlier on about the relationship between policy and structures, which is partly what that graph is. And I'm trying to think, you know, what are the experiences of internationalism, you know, bugbear of mine, what are the experiences of internationalism that can shape that can shape policy as it has an effect upon structures? So, you know, after that moment of backs against the wall you were describing, well, then there are international movements at that moment that take some of the ideas from the one place and allow them to appear in the experience of someone like a Tawney in a rich imperialist country like the UK. In a more recent case, you've got, if you want to think of an example of how you change public understanding and empathy of ongoing structural problems, look at the gay movement in the US and the way it responded to the AIDS crisis and how that was able to mobilise people's empathy in a more sort of structural way. So I'm thinking other examples drawn from the international sphere that might cut across some of the what potentially appears to be a sticking point between
policy elections don't change anything on the time frame that, that, that can be registered,
mm.
but we don't want to hang up our shoes and
yes.
give up.
Yeah. When countries are reconstructed, they tend to, after wars, they tend to be reconstructed in ways that make greater equality more likely. But those events become less and less through time. One issue internationally, one thing that makes it hard, is that social scientists and journalists and commentators in every country very often want to tell you what's terrible in their country. And in the more equal countries, they care more about things. So they will tell you that the level of child poverty is terrible in the countries where it's lowest, because they worry about it. And that means you don't get the prophesizing. You don't get people from these countries, apart from that one nice man from Helsinki. But even he does it quietly. You don't get people from the places that are working coming and saying, look, it works. In fact, you get the very opposite. So you do get the big Americans saying, if only you were truly free, you could be great and be like us. You know, we tell the rest of the EU27, you really ought to split off and the whole project should end, and it would all be in your own interest if you do what we do. Yeah, and okay, they don't listen to us. But I think one reason you get less obvious examples is that process. But the OECD, the OECD, this sort of, and they were once described only 5 or 6 years ago as a bunch of jackal economists who were dragging the world into a neoliberal hell. I've got some quote like that. The OECD economists in Paris are now beginning to take this very, very seriously. And that's an example, potentially a really progressive example of a switch. So you can see their report changing, where they now produce reports on education saying that competition between schools seems to make education worse, which the OECD certainly didn't say before. So possibly at that kind of level of boring international structures, the ILO, those things that we've given up on hope long, long, long ago, but which still produce these annual reports, still have a budget, still meet in Geneva, because it's not exciting, we might not spot it. The other thing is this enormous spread of relatively young people around the world now compared to the past. You know, experiencing life in another country in a university, it can't all be wasted. The equivalent of what those Victorians did on the Grand Tour is now much more common. But I'm not at all sure. We have the question about data, we just have too few examples to generalise too easily from. But the other sort of thing to make you want to pay, this has only been relatively recent. You know, go back to 1990. It wasn't obvious, even at the end when Margaret Thatcher resigned in 1990, what was going to happen. It certainly wasn't obvious when Tony Blair was elected in 1997, at least not to everybody, that wouldn't reverse it. We shouldn't kick ourselves too much, I think.
I'm an environmental educator, and for a long time environmental educators have been kind of in a paradigm of let's teach people about environmental issues, then they'll care, and then they'll change their behaviour. But we've seen there's a big gap between that sort of information deficit model. Does it seem to work? And so there's a growing movement, which I'm part of now, which is looking more at values and seeing that the values of research is showing that there's a set of intrinsic values of care and compassion and empathy and kindness and equality at one end, and that those underpin long-term commitment to environmental behaviours but also to social justice issues and so on. Then the opposite of that are the extrinsic values, which are more like status and power and image and hedonism and all those sorts of values down there. And this is why I've become more and more interested in inequality stuff, is because we know that in countries with high inequality, the values of those extrinsic values tend to be higher, and people more have more status anxiety and social anxiety because of the differences between wealth, and so people always want to try and get a bit richer. And so there's a lot of individualism as a response to that. as environmentalists, we're kind of interested in status anxiety because it leads to higher consumption rates. So people consume lots more status symbols and foreign holidays and all the rest of it to sort of display their status. And so we're working increasingly as educators to say we don't need to teach necessarily about environmental issues to do education that's for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We can explore things like status anxiety with young people and ask them to think, is this really what's making you happy, having this more wealth and status, or is it having more friends and kindness and compassion in your life? And those sorts of values, which I think you were describing as being quite strong in Finland, for example. And so it seems to me that status anxiety is kind of locks in inequality, because A, it kind of creates it in the first place, and then because status anxiety helps effectively grow the economy, it's in the interest of a lot of people to keep playing on our status anxieties through advertising and all sorts of cultural messages that we get about what a successful life looks like. And so it locks it in. And in order to let go of status anxiety, A, you either need to let go of it in a sense that actually I've seen through the bullshit, these things aren't going to make me happy, and you start to let go of it, you don't really worry about where you stand on status, or you have a more equal society. And so I wonder if, and it's a long term project, and I wonder if that's what's happening in countries which are more equal, is that the cooperative values and compassionate values are stronger in those societies and activated and reinforced quite actively.
That they appear to be, but they're not seen as cooperative values, they're just seen as normal. So it's not seen as, which makes it much easier. There's a book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt that I've always liked, which is about those values, but he also has on the right values of disgust, actually feeling disgust and dirt mattering to some people and affecting their voting. And if you're in a room like this, it's very unlikely there's somebody here who is kind of motivated by hierarchy, order, hates dirt, and so on. But Haidt's book is really interesting because those values are held by more people at the moment in the United States, and those values were held by people in Germany in 1938. They could be motivated by that. And in this country, you can spin up the population a year before an election. We did it before the European election in 2014, to really hate foreigners, and then the week after the election, they don't anymore because the tabloids haven't put it in the papers. So you do get this difference. I think it's mainly generational. I think people form a lot of their views when they're children or 16 or 17. And so one reason why change takes longer than we want is that you have to wait for entire generations to get big changes. My favourite example of this is nuclear war, where there were a tiny number of people, including Einstein, in the 30s, who knew that this was absolutely stupid. And then there were a larger group of hippies in the 60s who marched and knew it was stupid. And then you get to a point in the mid-80s where actually a majority of the establishment knew it was stupid. And so we decommissioned all our nuclear bunkers in 1992 secretly in this country. And now you can go visit them. And they don't make a big deal about that point. Just, they were decommissioned for some reason. It's because the powers that be worked out were all going to have 30 million would die in 2 weeks. And if some things happen like that, then this switch, and it's a bit like that graph I showed you of voting. You know, if a generation has been brought up with the idea, the 1980s idea, work hard, look after your money, don't squander it, save, you deserve what you want, get a house, your investment should rise, don't ever ask where the money comes from, your house price will rise forever. And those people who don't have that have just not been as good as you. That sticks with you for life. You don't change. Very few people change. But that view is unlikely to be held by a next generation who, A, can't get that anyway. There's one at the back.
Yeah,
I wanted to go back to that point you made rather at the end about the middle class sort of teetering around this point of creating greater social equality. I mean, it seems to me that for many people, getting to be middle class is hugely difficult, increasingly difficult, because of
Yeah, it's definitely changing. I'll just put that up so you have something else to look at if you're going bored. I once met a man who was about 60 at Wellington School on an open day at Wellington Public School. And I kind of got to know him a little bit and asked him, why have you sent your son there? And he was a very late father. He had about a 14-year-old son. And he said, so he'll be safe. And I sort of said to him, well, yes, you've increased his chances of being safe, but he won't be absolutely safe. Because I didn't tell him, but I've done research on what happens if you go to one of those schools but don't succeed in life, and it's actually not good news. He turned to me very angrily and went, no, he'll be absolutely safe. And of course it mattered, his father had worked out he'll die before his son reaches middle age. In a country like Britain, it really matters. The enormous difference and change now people haven't caught up with. So I live in a town where people are paranoid about where their child goes to school, more than ever. When I was 15, if I'd been sent to Magdalen College School, which was the nearest school to my school, I'd have been 20 times more likely to go to university, 20 times. Now the school that I went to, over half the children go to university. And they go to Manchester and Leeds. And the Magdalen College boys go to Manchester and Leeds. And the, you know, maybe one or two go to Oxford and Cambridge, but mostly go to Manchester and Leeds. The Russell Group have increased their intake 7% every year since 2012. So, you pay this money, or you move into the catchment of the posh con. You get your child into the Russell Group University. They tell you it's got to be AAB, but they'll bloody take CDE, to be honest, because the number of kids have gone down. And you get your degree in engineering or English or history, and you're 21, 22, and then you become a disappointment to your parents, if you're middle class, so with that word, because your chances, at the moment we're going through that period of parents behaving in ways that would have made sense to my parents, dramatic increases in my life chances, don't make much sense now, but the schools are really good at targeting. A third of children go private in Oxford. And what they do is they say, oh, your child's very good at rugby. You know, we have a bursary for... And they go, oh, somebody else got the bursary, but, you know. So they really pull them into the private schools. And don't give them something which is less and less advantage. Okay, they've got the posher accent and that network and so on, but that network is less and less useful. But the parents don't know this yet. There's this incredible lag from what would have made sense 20 years ago to what won't necessarily work now. But it's my example of the 30s. We got the NHS largely unopposed, apart from the Tories, not least because Labour were organising the health service during the war anyway, but because before the war, the middle class couldn't afford the money that they needed anymore for a doctor. And so there's pressure for that. Part of the reason we got comprehensive schools in the 60s was as we were becoming more and more equal, the middle class couldn't afford private school and they couldn't fix the 11 plus for their kids. So their children, some of them would have to go to a secondary modern. And if you don't have the middle class on your side, it is quite hard.
Yes, but what would become the point of what is missing? I mean, I can see the point about how health changes, how education changes, but what's going to be the point of absence, of loss, of what is it, you know, what kind of project will it be that will then produce that change?
I've got a graph of polling last year when the Brexit Party got to 30%. It was stunning. I mean, and the Tories are right down there. The scope for enormous change is absolutely evident. The 2017 election, the biggest, fastest swing, bigger than 1945, occurred. This election, in a different direction, outside the confidence limits of the largest poll held before the election. Right, the 78, 79 seat majority was as unlikely as a working Corbyn majority of 20 or 30. People are skedaddled all over the place, desperate for some hope. Trump in America is partly hope. It is. He's promised me salvation. I'll go for that. But we can't predict the future. We just know we are in times now which are much more unpredictable than the last 5 or 6 decades have been. And the last peak of inequality, that kind of 1913 to 1918 time, general strike, depression, was a similar period of kind of chaos. But you know, it doesn't repeat, and you really don't want it to repeat, because you don't want wars.
Should we make this the last question?
Looking at this graph, where are the kind of swings like located, if there is a pattern for that? And also, what's the kind of geography of this like? As in, is the result explicable in terms of concentrations of older voters and younger voters geographically?
What I should do is have PowerPoint with all the slides I don't put on so I can go. So there's a lovely graphic of the swings of the flood of votes, what actually happened. And the key thing is there were hardly any. Tiny. So a few Labour people didn't vote. A few more didn't vote. Hardly any Labour people voted Tory. Tories, almost no change. Same 14 million. Really, really small changes to get this result. Or if you want to put it really crudely, the Guardian and the tabloids managed to persuade a few million people who would have voted Labour not to do so. Other than that, almost nothing. And certainly not Labour voters voting Tory. That isn't. And the red wall's actually still there if you draw a cartogram. And the seats that change the suburban northern seats, they always neighbour a Tory seat. Every single seat that the Conservatives won is next door to a seat that was already Tory. You know, this story that it was the heart, it is just marginal. Abstentions rose overall. People were bored, but it wasn't dramatic.
Does that complicate your last point about this being a period of flux? People shifting more than...
Yes, but the shift I was talking about was between 5 days before and the election. 5 days, well, all the weeks before, it was narrowing. You know, you'd have to be incredibly optimistic to think. And of course, don't forget how awful a hung parliament would have been, because Jeremy Corbyn, I really like him, I vote for him. Jeremy Corbyn negotiating with other party leaders to form some kind of alliance with give and take. Anyway, you know, I'm quite happy we didn't have a hung parliament. But the volatility in that case was between what people said they would do 5 days before, and then when it came to the national election, they didn't do it. They didn't bother to go out. It was raining, it was cold. We haven't had a December election since 100 years. But we don't know, we're not sure. And it's possible we won't know that they pressed the panic button the day before, and rather than the normal number of Facebook ads that went out, they tripled them. I mean, we know the spending. And of course, the Facebook, but loads of older people aren't on Facebook. The kind of things that would make you more likely not to go out and vote. But it wasn't fixed in that way. I'll just want to leave you with this optimistic thing. You're never in a position where you're the most unequal country in Europe and you manage to hold on to that status 5 or 10 years later. It's really difficult. Peter Townsend, the old sociologist, in 1979 produced a list of the 10 poorest parts of Britain that the government had to invest in to improve health. And of course the Conservatives came in and they did nothing to these 10 poorest parts. 5 of them got dramatically better, just because that happens to places at the bottom. You know, so things are going to get better anyway at a chance. If bits of Brexit are as disastrous as we think they may be without even a hard Brexit, but just that any sensible firm in the EU27 who can possibly buy a widget from another country in the EU26 and not from us does it now, and you work out the effects of that, then the wealth of this country goes down, the poor have no wealth, so equality rises. The incomes of the FTSE 100 CEOs already dropped by 100. The banking salaries are at the peak. You don't pay people more money to come and work in the City of London when you're not hiring any graduates, which they're not doing at the moment. So I would be optimistic that we'll probably see a few years of inequality fall, but that's simply because it's got so bad. And we have to do something more than that to secure something much better. Do you want your last question?
Just on that point, So are we talking earned income or assets, or sort of central bank money printing? If you hold the assets, your total wealth is going to go up. That graph at the end, is that earned income? Or is that total...
That is income from all sources, with a tiny bit being interest. But income from all sources, benefits and earned, and investments and pensions.
So equities as well?
And equities as well. But yes, we can print money. But remember, just leave you on, anything can happen. When the coalition government was being formed in 3 days, the coalition government in 2010, when Gordon Brown wasn't getting on with Nick Clegg and then Cameron got on with Clegg and they formed that government, Gus O'Donnell, who was the chief civil servant at the time, told them they had to make an agreement in 3 days over the weekend because there might be a run on the pound otherwise. Now, we haven't had a run on the pound, but we still have the smallest, most precarious little currency with hardly any oil backing it up and a financial centre that doesn't look that safe. And we could be sitting in 5 years' time after the most almighty run on the pound, and lots of things could happen. You know, in Japan, house prices halved in a year in 1989-90. Is this currently the most expensive place in Europe? Why is this the most expensive place in Europe, given what it's setting itself up to do and be? Does it make sense? Is it a really safe place for dictators from around the world to invest their money in? Or might there be a risk that a government might come in one day which will take that wealth away from them? And it's, if people begin to appreciate the precarity, this is precarity for the rich, then what is currently happening here may be less sustainable. Yeah. We're turning into a treasure island, but the rich can safely keep their wealth and live separately in Carts and Kensington, and the majority of schools are not state schools, and the majority of hospitals are not state schools. But the idea it's going to be like this forever, it just never is. And the last 30 years have been based on the Big Bang and the expansion of the City of London. And there are no passports for the banks, and there are no plans to give the banks any passports or allow them to operate on the majority of continent on which they're sitting. That's the situation we're currently in right now. And we didn't know 4 months ago that would be the situation. It's quite exciting, and 12% of our GDP comes from banking. It's 4% of workers.
Your graph ended in 2010.
Yes.
If you were to extrapolate it now, would it keep going up? Forget the tax implications, but the top line.
The inequality to 1%?
Yeah. The total ownership, the income earned.
The income inequality, except for the effects of the FTSE 100, who really matter to the top 1%. So we have to check. One annoying thing of the Conservatives is that they've delayed when the Inland Revenue gives us the statistics. So we're always 2 or 3 years behind. And the Resolution Foundation have produced a brilliant report about it. So we don't quite know. The one to look out for is the European Banking Authority. Sorry to bore you with this. The European Banking Authority still releases numbers on how many bankers are paid over $1 million in the City of London. The minute that begins to drop, then we know that the average income of the top 1% will drop. Because those bankers are so important to the overall figure. You've got to be getting over £200,000 a year to be in that group. And then you're the poor person in that group. Yeah. I'm going to stop then. Thanks ever so much.
And let's thank Danny.
Thank you.